With that, we're going to go on to the internet and call this meeting to order. This is a June 9th meeting of the Public Utilities Commission. It's approximately 9:30 in the morning, and we're here in the state capitol. This is the time and the place for the PUC meeting. I'm Dusty Johnson, and joining me here today are Commissioner Steve Colbeck and Gary Hansen. With that, we will go ahead and turn first to Ms. Gregg for a status update on consumer affairs.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 141 contacts since the last report was prepared for the May 19, 2009 Commission meeting. 29 of the contacts involved telecommunication service, 31 of the contacts involved electric service, 8 contacts involved natural gas service, 3 contacts involved gas and electric service, 19 contacts involved cell phone service, 26 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, 1 contact was related to the Keystone XL pipeline, 1 contact involved wind energy, and 1 contact involved the grain warehouse division. 22 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 1,190 of the 1,249 complaints received in 2009 have been resolved, and 2,512 of the 2,513 complaints received in 2008 have been resolved.
Thanks, Ms. Gregg. Any questions for Ms. Gregg? Hearing none, we'll move into our docket work. Unless there's any objection, my thought would be that we would defer electricity item number 2, which is EL09-005. That's in the matter of filing by Xcel Energy for their economic development report and plan. That would be deferred, and as well move our pipeline safety docket, item number 1, PS09-002, to the end of the agenda. Anybody else have any suggested alterations to our agenda? Hearing none, we'll proceed. Our first item is electric number 1, EL09-003. It deals with Xcel Energy and their request for approval of revised rate sheets. And the question for the commission is, shall it approve those rate sheets, those revisions? Xcel Energy.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Wilcox here from Xcel Energy. On the phone today are Phil Zins and John Chow to answer questions. The company simply requests approval. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mr. Wilcox. Staff.
This is John Thurber for staff. The decrease in energy payment for both the occasional delivery energy service and time.
Mr. Thurber, if we could get you a little closer to the mic so we can make sure everybody on the worldwide internet can hear you.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Maybe try to swallow the mic there, and we'll see if that... There we go. Pull that thing close and give it another shot. Thanks.
Okay. The decrease in energy payment for both the occasional delivery energy service and time of delivery energy service was primarily driven by lower natural gas fuel costs. The increase in capacity payment for firm power was due to the increase in the cost of a planned combustion turbine unit. There was no change in the monthly metering fee. There are currently 2 customers on the occasional delivery energy service and no customers on the time of delivery energy service rate. Staff recommends approval of the tariff revisions.
Any other person wish to make comment at this time? Any questions from commissioners or advisors?
I just want to clarify, there's only about 2 customers on this rate.
Okay. Yeah, on the occasional rate, yep.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Wilcox, I want to make sure that I'm thinking about this filing in the right way. Is this best categorized as, you know, good news, bad news? The good news is that this is a strong indicator that the prices that Xcel Energy is paying for power have gone down fairly dramatically. And I suppose the bad news is for those people on this rate and that this provides them less revenue from distributed generation that they're selling back into the grid. Am I thinking about this in the right way?
I think that's exactly right, Mr. Chairman. You know, energy prices are somewhat volatile, and it's a little hard to predict the future, but there is some volatility in prices.
And so we shouldn't view this, or people on this rate, it shouldn't view this as any sort of a long-term situation. One thing we know for sure about these numbers is that they're likely to change in the next year or two. Is that also right?
I think that's pretty easily certain.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Wilcox, could you tell us somewhat the balancing effect of this? There's a reduction in the occasional delivery. There's a reduction in the time of delivery charge, and there's a reduction in the time of delivery energy service off-peak rate. However, there's an increase in the capacity payment or the on-peak delivery. What is the ultimate effect on the I would assume that you can have somewhat of an average with as few folks as we're looking at here.
I think I'm going to need to defer to Mr. Chow-Zins on this.
This, Mr. Chairman, this is Phil Zins of XL Energy. Could you repeat the question again?
Certainly. This is Commissioner Hansen. I'm just looking at it from the standpoint that you have three different items where there are reductions, and in one area there's an increase. The increase, of course, is on the – and I'm looking at what the overall effect is to the ratepayer.
Well, if you're talking about the time-of-day delivery service, that's the one where there are no customers. But even if there were, it would be hard to say because what they would get paid on average would be a function of how much they deliver on-peak versus off-peak and whether or not their delivery is firm capacity. They don't get a capacity payment on that tariff unless they deliver firm power, which is a 65% or better capacity factor. So it's really hard to predict what the impact would be on a customer. My guess is that on average it would be lower, but it really depends upon their delivery pattern.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Any comments or action?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that the Commission approve the revised rate sheets.
Was there an effective date in the filing? I don't remember.
There was no effective date, so it would be just the date of the order.
What's that?
It would just be the date of the order.
Then. Okay, gotcha, perfect. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we'll proceed to electricity item number 3. EL09-006, this does deal with Otter Tail Power Company and their request for approval of tariff revisions. Otter Tail Power.
I don't believe they're on the phone. This is Dave Jacobson from Commission staff, and this is simply a continuation of the cleanup of the contracts with deviations for the various cities served by Otter Tail, and this is for the city of Roslyn, which upon expiration of the contract reverted to the normally tariffed rate. This just cleans up the tariff page and deletes that contract from the tariff page.
Any questions? Hearing no questions, any comments or action? I'll just make the same... I'll just make the same comment I think we make each time, you know, one of these filings comes up, and that is, you know, this is good for transparency. You know, we're moving somebody off a rate that's not readily available to most people onto a rate that is readily accessible to anyone. So this is good from a transparency perspective. Other comments or action?
I'll move in EL09-006 that the Commission approve the tariff revisions.
Motion has been made. No second is required. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we'll proceed to the hydrocarbon pipeline portion of the docket. Item number one deals with HP09-001. This is the Keystone XL project. We've got a number of questions before the commission today, and we'll take them one at a time. The first question deals with staff's motion to establish a procedural schedule. Staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Kara Semler for staff. I think staff's motion filed the middle of May does speak for itself. We have not received any comments to staff's proposed schedule, so I'd certainly ask the commission to maybe adopt this schedule today because we've received no comments. However, if you'd like to wait till the end of June, I believe commission counsel could handle any comments that may come in via a conference call.
We've got a number of parties, and I would just mention, I mean, I should have taken up the party status question for Ruth Iverson and Martin Luke first, and certainly they can comment as though they were granted intervener status. Any interveners or the applicant want to make any comment on the proposed schedule?
Commissioner, this is Brett Kennecke calling for TransCanada. We have no issue with staff's proposed schedule, and we would ask that you adopt it.
Thank you, Mr. Kennecke. Other persons wish to make comment? All right, hearing none, any questions by commissioner and advisors? Commissioner Kolbeck.
I just have one. I just want to make sure that Ms. Iverson and Mr. Luke are taken care of. As you said, you should we do that first? Should we take care of that action first? Or?
The only benefit, of course, we use some level of informality. The only benefit they would get as interveners is the opportunity to make comment about this. That would be an opportunity we'd extend to anyone, regardless of their party status.
Scott Besmer
is joining the meeting.
But from a practical standpoint, because they're not in person or on the telephone, I'm not sure it makes a big difference. But if you prefer, we can certainly vote on their.
Well, no, I just wanted to make sure. I guess maybe.
Sir.
We know for sure they're not on the phone or want to make a comment. I guess I'd open it up for that. After that, I'll be comfortable with making the motion.
Any other persons wish to make comment on the procedural schedule? Hearing none, further commissioner questions? Comments or action?
I'll motion that the commission in HB09-001 adopt the procedural schedule as proposed by staff.
We've got some folks on the telephone line. We just ask that you mute your phone when you're not addressing the commission. Thanks. Other comment? We've got a pending motion. No second is required. Any comments? I think two things become pretty readily apparent. Number one, I applaud staff for putting together a procedural schedule that I think allows some room on the back end. We've got some flexibility in case any unanticipated delays pop up. I think it's always best when we're not directly under the gun. And I also think that this shows that collectively all of us learned quite a bit from the first process, the first Keystone Pipeline, and that I think having a good procedural schedule laid out like this and this looks very good to me. I think this is going to help make sure the process is accessible to everyone and operates in a pretty clean and orderly manner, regardless of what evidence is introduced and whatever the commission decision might be. Other comments? Hearing none, we do have a motion. We'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johns votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we have received intervention requests from two individuals, Ruth Iverson and Martin. I think it's Luke, or though it could be Leck or Luck. Are either of them on the telephone wishing to address the commission? Does the applicant or any other intervener have any opposition?
Brett Kennecke for TransCanada again. We have no opposition to either intervention petition.
Okay, thank you. Staff?
No objection.
Okay. Any questions? Hearing none, any comments or action? I'm sorry, go ahead, Commissioner Hanson.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that the commission grant party status to Ruth M. Iverson and Martin R. Luke.
Motion has been made. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, the final question on this docket today is how shall the commission proceed regarding proposed consulting contracts? We'll turn it this time to staff.
Thank you, Kara Semler for staff again. I actually do not think the commission probably needs to take action on this question. The order, and I can't recall the date of the meeting, you did give the executive director the authority to enter into these contracts, conditioned upon any comments received, of course, by interveners, and we didn't receive any comments. So I believe she already has the authority to enter into the contract. I put this on the agenda just in case we received some so we could handle it today.
Perfect. Maybe just to be extra cautious, we'll pause and see if anybody has any comments on this information. Any comments on this information? Hearing none, unless there are any commissioner questions.
Ms. Semler, in your writing or your letter about the three engineering firms or the engineering firms and the natural resource group. And the doctor in there, is any of that changed, or are those still the three people that you're recommending?
We do recommend those three consultants. We feel very comfortable that they'll provide great help to staff and and anyone else who may have concerns regarding this docket.
Thank you.
Unless there are any other questions, and I think our work on this question will be taken care of by the earlier order. So thanks for the reminder, Ms. Semler. With that, we'll proceed to natural gas, item number one, NG09-003. This is MidAmerican's filing for its 2008 Economic Development Report and its 09 plan. MidAmerican.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Susan Stewart from MidAmerican. This is our annual filing with the Commission of our report on showing the 50-50 sharing of economic development expenditures between the company and the customers. Again, in 2008, we spent quite a bit over our budgeted amount. We spent $119,260 for staff and local and regional economic development activities. I'd be glad to answer any questions, and I have Catherine Kuhnert, our Vice President of Economic Development, and Brad Howard, our Economic Development Representative who covers South Dakota, on the telephone with me if you have any questions.
Staff.
This is John Thurber for staff. Staff has reviewed the 2008 actual expenditures and compared.
Mr. Thurber, that mic's not coming through very good. Let's see if Ms. Kramer can loan you hers. Thanks.
Is this better?
Yeah, a little bit. Maybe get it closer. Thank you.
Staff has reviewed the 2008 actual expenditures and compared it to the 2008 Commission-approved budget. MidAmerican did not meet the business attraction incentive spending goal due to the increase in staffing expenditures, but overall they did exceed the approved budget at the expense of MidAmerican shareholders. The 2009 proposed budget is slightly different from the 2008 budget in that it includes a full year of staffing in the budget. As a result, the budget for economic assistance programs and business attraction incentives were reduced. The 2009 proposal is similar to the Commission-approved budget for 2007. Staff would recommend approval of the 2008 Economic Development Report and the 2009 Economic Development Plan.
Questions? Go ahead, Commissioner Colbeck, if you had some.
No.
Okay. Well, this is more of a general question, and I'll ask it of both MidAmerican and staff, but I mean, these programs, I can't ever figure out what I think about these programs. I mean, if I think they're great and so all of the, you know, IOUs should do them, or if they're not a very good fit with a regulatory mission, I can't figure out whether to be effective. We need to put more money in them or take away money. I guess my big picture question would be, these were put into place in a time when there was excess generation capacity on the system. And so building an economy not only made sense for the economy and for the state, but for ratepayers. In an environment not featuring excess capacity, does a program like this make as much sense? And again, either the applicant or staff can respond.
This is Susan Stewart. I just want to point out that this is a gas filing. Not an electric. This is in our gas rate.
No, that's a good point. Xcel's got a similar founded day on electric, so my question was sort of for both. So you're right, it doesn't apply as much to MidAmerican, so I'll revise the question. Do you think this filing still makes sense? I mean, from a ratepayer perspective, does it have a good cost-benefit analysis? Not that that's calculated, but does this still make sense to do from a regulatory perspective?
I'll just make one comment, then I'd like to turn it over to Catherine or Brad if they have any more comments. But I think in many of our jurisdictions, economic development expenses are shared on a 50-50 basis like effectively what's being done here. So I think this just may be a regulatory precedent. And I'd ask Catherine and Brad if they have any other questions.
Yes, Susan, thank you. This is Catherine Kuhnert speaking. I would just make a couple comments in the sense that local economic development organizations need assistance, and they do turn to utilities for that assistance due to the fact that we can bring resources, expertise, and experience to them that they would not otherwise be able to have, be able to afford, et cetera. The value of these programs and where we put our dollars is much driven by what the local economic development partners need, that they feel that they need in order to be effective, whether it's business retention or business expansion. As we know, business retention is extremely important to the sense that it is the bread and butter of the economy. 80% of all growth comes from existing business. So from that aspect, it's extremely important. The other aspect then is to be able to attract the businesses. So if you do have some loss or you want to keep expanding your economy, obviously, for the revenue that affords many benefits to many communities. And as the utility partner, we see great value in participating at this level and really working to make sure that our dollars go where we know our local economic development professionals need that assistance.
Well, and I really do understand the importance to the economy and the importance of the community, and I understand the value of these programs. I just, every time these come up each year, both the Excel filing and the Mid-American filing, I try to make myself feel that much more comfortable that it's something that ratepayers should be investing dollar for dollar with the shareholders. I mean, there are lots of things that are of importance to communities and importance to an economy that we don't have cost recovery for. Can you give me any insight into how this is of a system benefit and why this makes sense to have, you know, a dollar for dollar match with?
Well, are you asking, Commissioner, may I ask for a little bit of clarification? This is Catherine Coonert again. Are you asking for what specific programming, or are you asking for us to identify specific actions?
No, I thought your report did a good job of laying out the progress and the successes that have happened in Mid-American's territory. I mean, there's a lot of detail in there, clearly a lot of successes. To me, establishing that a program is of value is not sufficient to say that it's something that utilities should be getting, you know, cost recovery for, and that ratepayers should match in dollar for dollar for. Now, I'm not saying that I'm not supportive of these programs. I mean, we've approved these, you know, each of the 5 years I've been on the commission. I just always in the back of my mind wonder, I mean, should we be spending ratepayer dollars on anything that's good for a community? I mean, should we be building parks? Should we be, I mean, at some point, I think you can make a strong argument on the electric side. Granted, this is natural gas, but electric, when there was excess generation, that building an economy, taking more of that, you know, offloading more of that excess generation could come to some real benefit for the ratepayers. Maybe that's true on the natural gas side, too. I mean, are there, you know, if a business leaves, are you stuck with capacity on a large pipeline that may impose costs on ratepayers? I mean, just help me understand some of the ratepayer benefits that a program like this would deliver. Maybe even unmeasurable, maybe even long-term, but can you just make me feel better that this ultimately results in benefits?
Commissioner, this is Brad Howard with Mid-American Energy, and I guess from a standpoint from the gas system, you don't have any extra benefits from that, but from the community standpoint, with the many small towns in South Dakota, as Catherine said, the retention of business is so important, as it is with the utility, to keep those businesses strong and functioning. And you know, what these small towns use what little money that is given to them to help support the local economy, the local businesses, and even if it's a quality of life thing, that helps keep the businesses strong and keeping them in that community and keep businesses interested in those communities. So I think that overall that's what we're looking for, is to try to keep these communities strong so that they look attractive to businesses that are considering South Dakota.
Yeah, and I think I would just like to, again, reiterate my comment on the fact that so many of these organizations would not be able to do what they need to do to sustain the revenue needed for a growing community or even a sustaining community if it were not for utilities participation. I think that is what is so important. And, you know, if there's not a strong utility provider stepping up to help them, you know, we're not selling our product. And if we're not selling our product, then they're not having any business. And it's that circle, I think, that we get ourselves into that affects then the revenues of the budget. Those are the projects we work on, are making sure that You know, they're bringing in, those businesses are sustaining that economy that provides the revenues for that community to exist and grow. So whether it's our commodity that we're concerned about or the business using our commodity or that community that's needing to maintain that business, whether it's directly through the use of our product or through quality of life, I think there's great impact to our ratepayers to make sure that those towns are viable. It turns them into those residents need to make sure that the costs, you know, are affordable to them as well.
Well, and I appreciate the give and take, and I want to make it very clear. I'm not suggesting for a minute that these dollars aren't put to good use, and I'm not suggesting for a minute that there hasn't been great progress and success that has resulted from this program. I just think at some point, you know, maybe before the year's out, you know, the commission probably has to have a discussion, not related to this docket. I mean, this docket is great. It's very good. It's very thorough. But, you know, why do we only have two of the six investor-owned utilities participating in this? And I understand there's some historical precedent for that. You know, when did the rate case come up, and when was economic development a big deal for, you know, commissioners on the first floor and administration on the second floor or legislators on the third floor? But it seems odd to me that we've got a patchwork quilt where it makes sense to deploy these dollars in the Sioux Falls area, generally speaking, but if it makes sense, why aren't we doing it in the Jim River Valley and in the Black Hills and MDU or Otter Tail service territory? I think it's just the asymmetry that every year has me wondering, either it works or it doesn't. I mean, either it's a good use of ratepayer dollars or it isn't. And so, hopefully, you know, sometime in the next few months we can have that discussion and figure out what makes sense. So thank you to Mid-American for – yeah, go ahead, Mr. Jacobson.
Yeah, you heard the company side of the story. I thought it's enlighten you as to some of the other things that occur with economic development. Some of these ideas have been promoted by staff for decades. We had previous memos going way back that highlight some of these things. The one issue that's came up in the past is the fairness issue, collecting funds from everybody on a mandatory basis for the benefit of few. That's been one of the ideas brought up before regarding these. The interesting enough for a gas company, when you include these in rates, the basis for some of the more recent rate cases for Mid-American Energy have been their growth in investment. And so in a way, what as this does, if it doesn't contribute to growth or to the degree it does, it can be viewed as a precipitator of rate case increases. As you stated, the benefits are not measurable. There are innumerable economic development organizations out there now that primarily operate on a voluntary basis instead of a mandatory basis. And, you know, when people are unable to pay their bills, this can be looked at as one of the reasons why their bills are at the level they are. And as you say, there are right now four companies and maybe very shortly three companies that don't have ratepayer participation and have not requested ratepayer participation, yet we know that they do are involved with economic activities, but they choose to finance it strictly through shareholder dollars instead of a mandatory rate item in bills. And the idea that when you pay your utility bill that you should pretty much be just paying for the commodity that you're purchasing and not have hidden costs in there or costs you aren't aware of in there, you know, that's one of the things that the commission should consider. So those are just some of the things on the other side, but we certainly appreciate and understand what the company is saying and what past and present commissioners feel about that too. So,
well, and I appreciate, you know, MidAmerican allowing us to, you know, run down a rabbit trail here on issues that are, you know, broad issues, philosophical issues as opposed to, you know, particular line items in their filing. So thanks much for that. Other commissioner questions? Mr. Rislov, comment or question?
Yes, this is Greg Rislov, if I could. We've talked about the issue in general, and I think you've noted it well. The economic theory behind it, as far as rate making is concerned, is that business development leads to job development, leads to stabilized or increased sales, which should, in a given capacity situation, lead to lower per unit cost for each and every ratepayer. And that's what the commission is shooting for with these programs. The issue comes in at the level of plant the company, at which the company is operating currently. Will we be reducing marginal cost or increasing marginal cost? If we have a given amount of plant where throughput is going through, we can reduce marginal cost. If they have to expand capacity significantly, that may lead to increased marginal cost. And so the trick here is to know where that dividing line is. Now, with that said, there are additional benefits related to job development and stabilizing sales within an economy. And frankly, as we debate this issue, Dave is correct. There's a lot of cases where staff, disagreed with running these costs or rates. But in fairness, for the companies and the commission, this is a chicken and egg problem. Which one is it, the chicken or is it the egg? Are we helping or are we costing ratepayers? And I think over the years of debate, and it went on for about 17, 18 years of debate, it was decided by that group of commissioners back then that they would give it a try, thinking that for the amount of money we spend on these programs and the potential good we could do, the odds of decreasing marginal cost outweighed those of increasing marginal cost. With that said, as you noted, only two utilities have those rates, and frankly, the reason why is that staff accepted those filings from the utilities, which appear to be interested in operating those programs on a basis which the commission could approve. I think in general, the reflection of the utilities not having the program stems from the fact that they have not come in with a filing, showing that they're willing to develop such a program that can prove to the commission that it will extend benefits to ratepayers in general, even at the, well, what is really a rather small cost and overall cost of service. And I guess that's where I would leave it, just looking at a strictly economic perspective. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, this is Commissioner Hansen. I'm not sure if I have a question in this or not, but I noted that last year $10,000 was budgeted to economic assistance programs and $17,000 was spent, and this year approximately a third of that amount is being budgeted for economic assistance programs. My guess is that economic assistance programs are probably the more valuable of the programs from standpoint of attracting opportunities or attracting businesses to the area. I know that one of them is labeled business attraction. However, Mr. Chairman, perhaps we could have some type of a informal meeting where we could have some discussions over this, receive some education from our standpoint, have some give and take. My concern is that when I look at the individual community support programs, they're receiving somewhere around the $250 mark, and I recognize that there's some validity in basing the amount of monies upon population to an extent, but certainly some of those smaller populations have a much greater challenge in raising funds than, for instance, Sioux Falls does. And so when I see a very large portion going to Sioux Falls and a smaller portion going to and I don't mean to be critical of it, I just don't quite understand why more funds would not go to smaller communities, giving them a better opportunity to compete and provide economic opportunities, because as small towns go, so goes South Dakota. And so from that standpoint, I'm concerned, and I've voiced this in the past,
years that I would encourage the companies to look at providing a greater resource to the smaller communities. And I'd just like to have some dialogue, some discussion as to why that hasn't taken place. And if you feel there's a question in there or you need to comment, I'd be happy to hear from you.
This is Catherine, Mr. Commissioner. I'm more than happy to have a future discussion with you on where our investments are made and why and the how. I'll just give you a brief overview now. Many instances, the programming that those organizations have, the staffing, et cetera, their overhead is much greater because they have much more activity going on. They have much more ongoing programming going on, so their costs are so much greater. So we've made that assessment of what they need in order to do business, in order to work the area, the region, the community that they serve versus the smaller ones. Maybe, you know, they don't even have full-time staff. They don't have any programming. So what we're trying to do is just give them the basics that they're needing in order to do the basics that they see fit for their communities. So we'll definitely be more than willing to discuss it. We'll be more than happy to review it with you. And we can reassess and reevaluate where our contributions go as we look at the programming and the program of work and the business plan and the budgets that each of these areas have compared to what it looks like within our service area.
Thank you. I would like to have that discussion because I see the resources are really significant for Sioux Falls from the standpoint of the funds that they can raise. And like you say, some of the other towns simply are lacking it. Well, they don't have paid staff. They don't, in some instances, they're almost sharing or it's out of somebody's kitchen practically for the economic development opportunities. So I'd just like to see what we can do there. Thank you. And by all means, I'm very appreciative of the program and what you do in helping out. And I don't mean to downplay that in any fashion because the funds that you do provide are essential to them. So we appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, those were good comments, and it certainly doesn't escape the Commission's notice, Mid-American, that you spent $119,000 last year, and that was above and beyond what you had committed to doing, and those are your dollars above and beyond the $100,000. And so I think you've got a clear idea of the value that this brings. I think you know exactly what you want to do with this program. I think the problem isn't with Mid-American. I think the issue is with the Commission, and that I think we need a fuller understanding of what is the mission statement from the Commission's perspective about what do these programs do. I mean, are these to target rural areas? Are these to target the areas where you get the best cost-benefit analysis? What exactly are these programs to do, and if they bring such value, to what extent should they be expanded? And if they don't bring value, to what extent should they be revised to bring maximum value? So.
This is Susan Stewart. I would just point out that this is approximately the same kind of budget that we've been putting before you now for a number of years, and we would welcome any input from you about your perception of the way we should change things.
Yes, and again, I'll just, reiterate what Commissioner Hansen said. This is a good program, and I don't think the issues with Mid-American. I just think the Commission, it doesn't bother you because you're one company and you're doing a good job serving your communities. We just have a whole state, and the asymmetry, I think, raises some questions. So thanks for helping us begin this conversation. Other questions or comments?
Commissioner, I might have one comment on the lighter side of this. In looking at the newspaper articles that come out when these funds are distributed, it may, speaking on behalf of ratepayers, it may be nice for the company to mention that the ratepayers provided these funds instead of just mentioning the company, too, is what I've seen in the past. So.
Well, and as we were
on the lighter side, that's a serious comment, Dave, and that's a good thought.
And John Smith did mention, to me as an aside, that one value that these programs bring is, frankly, when people have good jobs, it's easier for them to pay their bills. And I think we've heard anecdotal evidence from a number of the utilities that, folks falling behind on their monthly bills is an issue. And so that's one piece of value that a program like this does at least theoretically add. So other comments or questions or action?
Mr. Chairman, I will move that the Commission approve the 2008 Economic Development Report and the 2009 Economic Development Plan.
Motion has been made. Any further discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson.
Aye.
Colbeck.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much to MidAmerican.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we're holding pipeline safety to the end, so we'll move into telecommunications. Item number one is TC08-135. This is a complaint filed by Orbitcom against Verizon regarding unpaid access charges. And the question for the commission today regards procedural schedule. The parties jointly filed that. Who would like to take first shot at it?
Mr. Chairman, this is Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of Orbitcom this morning. The parties participated with staff attorney Karen Kramer in developing this procedural schedule. We had an opportunity also to discuss hearing dates at that time, and so I think all parties are in agreement as to the dates in the schedule and the manner in which this case should proceed. So I think we're simply asking that the commission adopt the procedural schedule this morning. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Moore. Other parties?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, I'm Dave Gertis, a lawyer from Peer, represent Verizon Business, and I'd agree with Ms. Moore's comments.
Staff?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff, and staff would ask that you approve the stipulation.
Any questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
I'll motion TC08-135 that the Commission approve the procedural schedule.
Motion has been made. Any further discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks. Item number two is an application of Broadvox CLEC for a COA to provide interexchange services in South Dakota. And the question for the commission is, shall it grant that COA? Is anyone representing the applicant online or in person? Seeing not, any comments from staff?
Thank you, Commissioner. This is Tim Binder for staff. Broadvox did file on March 26th for a certificate of authority for interexchange telecommunications and local exchange services in South Dakota. They're proposing to offer services to residential and commercial customers in existing Quest territories. Commission staff does recommend granting the certificate of authority to Broadvox CLEC LLC, subject to the conditions that no prepaid services are offered and deposits are not required nor accepted without the prior approval of the commission, and that the certificate of authority be subject to rural safeguards.
Thanks much. Questions? Comments? Action? I would move that the commission grant the COA to Broadvox CLEC, LLC with the recommendations and safeguards put forth by staff. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, item number three is an application of CVC CLEC for a COA to provide interexchange and local exchange services in South Dakota. Today, shall the commission grant that COA? Anyone from the applicant on the line? Hearing none, staff.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. This is Terry LaBrie Baker with staff. On April 6th, CVC CLEC LLC filed its application for a certificate of authority to provide local exchange service and interexchange service in South Dakota. CVC has requested a waiver from providing the financial statements as this is a new company. There were no interveners to the docket. CVC agrees to the restrictions from providing prepaid services, including prepaid calling cards, and from accepting deposits or advanced payments. CVC has also indicated that they intend to offer switched access service sometime in the future, and staff have had discussions with them regarding the additional requirements for switched access as well as the pending rule changes for switched access with the company. CVC has filed according to our administrative rules, and staff recommends granting the waivers from providing the financial statements and approving the certificates of authority for local exchange and interexchange with the restrictions mentioned previously and subject to rural safeguards.
Thanks. Questions?
They CVC filed some tariffs. They understand that we're not accepting the tariffs or any way granting that.
Correct.
Okay.
So those can be considered more as an informational portion of the filing.
Yeah, they are not required, so we didn't even acknowledge them as a part of
it. Perfect. Other questions?
I'll motion to TC09-015 that the commission grant the COA for CBC CLEC LLC with the required granting the waivers of 2010-32-312, 2010-24-2-9, and other recommendations by staff.
Motion having been made, is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. Telecom item number 4 deals with a filing by Quest for approval of revisions to its exchange and network services tariff number 1. Anyone from Quest want to address this item?
Morning, Mr. Chairman. George Baker Thompson for Quest. I have with me today Dave Ziegler as our regulatory expert. I think the stated purposes of this tariff revision is to give Quest the ability to respond to natural disasters. And let me give you a little background, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. Since 2007, Quest has dealt with two very destructive tornadoes, some bad ice storms in Iowa, and massive flooding across Iowa and South Dakota during spring storms. And during that process of providing services to folks who had lost their business or their residences through one of these natural disasters, we decided to waive charges for a variety of services we gave these folks who, in many cases, didn't even have a home to go to. We determined after we did that we should review our process for doing so in all 14 states in which we're the local exchange incumbent. And we wanted explicit approval in light of general prohibition against providing services at low cost for these sorts of temporary and extraordinary situations.
Mr. Thompson, we're starting to lose you every other syllable. Is there?
Let me adjust my mic, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, perfect. Thanks. We just started losing you about 10 seconds ago. Go ahead.
Okay. In any event, as a practical matter and as my final comment, it's cheaper to have an explicit notice versus litigating even one complaint about provision of services below cost. So we ask approval of our tariff revision, and I'll stand for any questions.
Okay, thanks. Staff.
This is Terry LaBrie Baker again with staff. We've reviewed the filing. We don't have any objections to the tariff revisions, and we'd recommend that the commission approve it.
Okay, questions?
Mr. Thompson, when you say that you'd like to offer alternative replacement services, could you give me some examples of that?
Yes, Commissioner Colbeck. At times we've given out cell phones, prepaid calling cards. We've installed a mobile trailer adjacent to City Hall or the police station in one of the tornado locations, as I recall. And that trailer had a phone bank inside of it that folks could use to call their relatives and let them know they were safe.
Okay. That's what I thought. I'm sure your filing reflects that, but I just wanted to be on the public record that you're not going to alleviate service. You're just going to provide some other form of service.
That's correct, Mr. Commissioner. Our experience in these incidents is that they're relatively short duration. I'd say 60 days or less, so that we're not providing services below cost for any significant period of time.
All right. Thank you.
Commissioner Johnson here, Mr. Thompson. And I think this is clear from your filing, but we're not talking about Quest changing its operating procedure in these situations. We're just making sure that the wording better reflects this option and makes it clear that you will take advantage of these opportunities and do the best you can when you have that opportunity.
Yes, sir. That's absolutely correct.
Perfect. Great. Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
I motion in TC09-018 that the commission approve the tariff revisions.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we'll move to telecom item number 5. This does deal with a filing by Wireless Alliance for relinquishment of its eligible telecommunications carrier designation. Anyone from Wireless Alliance wish to address the commission?
Mr. Commissioner, Talbot Wysorek for Wireless Alliance. The pleading is simply to relinquish the ETC status. The commission might remember the Wireless Alliance is located around the Sioux Falls metro area, and Wireless Alliance would be releasing the ETC status. There is still a wireless ETC in the area, and all the LECs are ETCs.
Mr. Wysorek, we're losing every other syllable. Now it may be an issue on our end, but if we could get you to repeat that last sentence, that'd be great.
Certainly. Wireless Alliance area, where it's an ETC, there is currently existing another wireless ETC, and the RLECs are all ETCs, so it would not create a situation where an area was unserved or that there was no eligible telecommunications carrier in the area.
All right, staff.
Thank you, Commissioner. This is Terry LaBrie-Baker again with staff. Wireless Alliance has filed according to our administrative rules. There were no interveners in the matter, and staff would recommend approving the relinquishment of ETC designation.
Questions? Ms. LaBrie-Baker, I'm looking at Exhibit B, the notice, which I thought was quite good. You know, I understand the reticence of a telecommunications provider to advertise for its competitors, but I just wonder, it makes reference to a website. Were you comfortable with that? I guess there is a 1-800 phone number, but did you consider any other possibility, or is this probably the most appropriate?
We didn't have any issues with that.
Ms. Wysorek, with regard to I'm trying to think about the effect on the end use consumer here, and the one that I think you address very clearly in your filing is that, you know, Lifeline link up, you're going to have an $8.25 credit that isn't going to be applied to people on their monthly bill. That's a relatively small number, I would guess, of the Wireless Alliance customers in these areas. For other folks who aren't on Lifeline, they're not going to see any change in the kind of service they're seeing today, are they? I mean, there's anything going to be changed on their bill? There's anything going to be changed on really anything?
No, there won't be any change to other customers. Wireless Alliance will still be doing business in the area, and those regular customers will continue and will not even receive this letter.
Perfect. Other questions? Any comments or action? I will move that the commission grant the petition for relinquishment of ETC status for Wireless Alliance. Was there a time? I know, Mr. Wysorek, you talked about a timeline of notification in your filing. Do we need to do anything with the timing or the effective date of our order to allow you to make that notice?
The letter is designed so it will, the relinquishment will occur 45 days from the date of the letter. I think what the commission could do is issue an order terminating the ETC designation on August 1st or 45 days from when that letter goes, whichever occurs later. And I would propose that I would provide a copy of that letter to staff when it goes out.
Okay, I think we got all that. Good, thanks very much. Motion has been made, and I would incorporate either of the suggested wording options in the order Ms. Wysorek outlined and provide some discretion to council in an effective date. Motion's on the table. Any further discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecom item number 6, TC09-021, does deal with AT&T Communications of Midwest and the requested approval of its access services and network interconnection services tariff. AT&T, any comments, Ms. Allen?
Mr. Chairman,
This tariff is being filed just to clarify the bill dispute language in the access tariff, and we request approval.
Thanks very much. Comments by staff?
This is John Thurber for staff. The tariff filing sets forth the written documentation necessary to support a billing and dispute claim for dedicated access and switched access services. Staff recommends approving the tariff revisions with an effective date of June 10, 2009.
Questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve the tariff revisions with a effective date of June 10, 2009.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecom item number 7 deals with the filing by RC Communications for an extension of an exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switch access rates. But the question today for the commission is, shall it grant intervention to any parties that have filed? I didn't check right before I came up, but I think we have at least Mid-Continent. Have there been others? Doesn't sound like it. Mid-Continent, do you wish to address your petition?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, my name is Dave Gertis. I'm a lawyer from Pier, and I represent Mid-Continent Communications. As stated in the intervention petition, Mid-Continent does compete with RC Communications, and for that reason seeks intervention.
Thank you. Any comments from RC? Dave, if we could get you to...
Would you like to sit?
Good morning, Commissioners. Margo Northrup on behalf of RC. We do not object to the petition to intervene filed by Midco.
Thanks, Ms. Northrup. Staff?
This is Karen Kramer from staff, and staff would recommend granting intervention to Mid-Continent.
Thanks. Any comments or questions by commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, is there any action? I will move that the commission grant intervention to Mid-Continent Communications. Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we'll proceed to an addendum to our agenda. It is Electric 09-007. Otter Tail Power Company has filed for an extension of an electric service agreement for the supply of bulk interruptible power between them and Valley Queen Cheese Factory. Any comments by Otter Tail Power?
Yes, Chairman Johnson and Commissioners, this is Dave Prozick with Otter Tail Power Company. I just have two brief clarification comments in this docket. The first item is I'd like to clearly state the company and customers' intentions in this docket. Our request to the commission is to request a 30-day extension of the electric agreement. This extension request is filed on less than 30 days' notice pursuant to 20-10-13-20, effective to our filing date. And my second item...
I think this is probably an issue on our end because this is the third time it's happened, but since we're getting a little bit of breakup, maybe speak... as close to your mic as you can and relatively slowly, and then hopefully our misses will correspond with your pauses. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'll restart. I do have two brief clarification comments in this docket. The first one is I wanted to take the moment here to clearly state the company and customers' intentions in this docket. Our request to the commission is to request the 30-day extension of the electric service agreement. This extension request is filed on less than 30 days' notice pursuant to 20-10-13-20, effective to our filing date. And then the second item I wanted to mention is, as we stated in our filing, we will know by the end of this week as to whether or not a new electric service agreement would be advanced. If the customer, which is Valley Queen Cheese, seeks a new electric service agreement on the bulk interruptible service rate, we would then again promptly seek a new ESA approval request on less than 30 days' notice. And if LA Queen Cheese chooses not to take service on the bulk interruptible, we would advance them to our other available and applicable retail service rates. And I just discussed this with these points with Dave Jacobson, and I'm available for any other questions.
Thank you very much. Staff.
Thank you, Commissioner. This is Dave Jacobson. The point he was trying to make is that in the filing, it wasn't clear that this request for approval was filed with the request for approval with less than 30 days' notice. That is their intention. So if the commission chooses to approve this filing, it will be with less than 30 days' notice. Then subsequently, if another agreement is reached with Otter Tail for the ongoing provision of service, that would also be filed for approval at the next commission meeting, which would be with less than 30 days' notice. That's what Dave Prozick was trying to clarify there. Other than that, typically in a case like this where the contract expires and isn't realized by the company until expiration, and then they come back for an extension like this, I feel obligated to say that it's possible that the commission could rule that the contract had expired, the default rate would be a normally tariffed rate, and thus the customer and the company would have to default to that. However, in the past, the commission has, for the purpose of the greater good, if you will, allowed the contract rate to remain in effect so as to avoid rate confusion, if you will. And then, you know, have the parties continue their progress towards a new agreement under the contract rate. And that's what we would recommend here, I guess. Hopefully this situation can be avoided in the future where the expiration is addressed before it actually occurs. So with that, we would recommend approval of the filing as filed.
And so at this point, they're just seeking an extension to June 30 at the end of this month.
That's correct. What they've said is that they should have a new agreement or the resolution of the discussions within a week from now, probably.
Okay. Questions?
I have one for Otter Tail. Is that still, you know, as of today, are we still looking at the end of June date to have this new rate developed?
Yes, Commissioner Kolbeck, that's correct.
Okay. Because if we're going to extend the date, we don't want to be here in 2 weeks trying to go to the middle of July. You think that that's a sufficient amount of time?
We do, and if it concerns the commission to extend this from 30 days to 60, we'd be willing to do that. But we're pretty confident that we can get this turned around, as Dave mentioned here, in a week, and get everything prepared and time for him to review to get it on the agenda. I believe the next meeting, I think he said, was June 23rd.
Okay. Well, and that's fine. I just, you would know better than I if you can get this rate turned around, so I'll trust in your judgment.
Thank you very much.
Other questions? Any comments or action?
Commissioners, I would just add one thing. I would say that this treatment that we're allowing to occur is, I would probably say in the order, it's non-precedent setting in that we're allowing this on an individual case basis because we don't want companies to become lax at addressing an expiration of contracts and allow this to happen too much in the future. So.
That's a good point, Mr. Jacobson, and with that, I would move the commission grant the extension of electric service agreement to June 30th, making it clear that this is with less than 30 days' notice, and that the order should reflect the fact that this is, you know, non-precedent sighting and non-precedent setting and an individual situation. Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. All right. With that, we will go back to pipeline safety, item number one. I believe the last item on our agenda today, PS09-002. Sorry for the delay. I thought I had to sneeze, but didn't get the satisfaction. This is a petition of the Commission Pipeline Safety Program Manager for declaratory ruling. And the question for the Commission today is, how shall the Commission rule on that petition for declaratory ruling? Staff, comments?
I wonder if we should start with Mr. Gerdes, as he did file a motion to oppose the ruling today. So I wonder if we should start there.
Well, I don't certainly, I mean, if staff doesn't, you know, doesn't mind, I mean, normally I think we teed up with, you know, the moving party making their request and then anybody who opposes it, you know, I mean, he's at this point. Now, granted, we've got a filing from, in fact, two filings from staff, so I think we understand your position well. But I would ask at this point if you want to augment that in any way. Now, of course, we'll give you some rebuttal because you may want to respond to his opposition.
Sure. Well, I was thinking Mr. Gerdes is the moving party today as filing the last motion, but I will certainly go for it here.
Well, no, let's make sure we do this right.
Yeah, maybe Mr. Smith has a...
I mean, we've got a petition for declaratory ruling. That's the question for the commission today. In what way is Mr. Gerdes, or rather his client, the moving party? I mean, I've seen his filing. It seems as though he is in opposition to making any sort of a declaratory ruling today. I guess, you know, he's making the statement that you don't even have the right to make this, to make that filing. Mr. Smith, any thoughts on, I don't know that it matters a lot. We're going to hear everybody's take on it, but.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess, I think what Kara's point is Dave's, although not denominated that way, a little piece of it appeared to be something in the nature of a motion to continue, you know, for, to, in order to afford additional time for additional, you know, exploration of the facts and the law. Is what I, at least I understood the one paragraph to say that, Dave. But is that the point, Kara, kind of?
Yes, but again, it doesn't matter.
Does it make sense to almost tee this up a little bit different and just take the question? I mean, in staff's comments filed yesterday, I mean, I think you broke it down that, number one, the commission should probably make a determination as to whether or not the staff's a party. Does it make sense to take that issue first before we dive into the merits of anything else?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you can, I mean, I think the commission can handle it any way it wishes. I haven't made any motions. I just opposed what was before me, which was the petition. I was given to understand that the petition would be decided today. Without any input from anybody else, and took the position that that really wasn't fair to the commission or to anybody else, because it's a one-sided petition, and so that was essentially where my comments came from. Now, I appreciate the fact that staff has now, in their second filing, suggested that maybe some time should go past, and we can get this thing put together in a more understandable fashion so that the commission can proceed in an orderly fashion. I know Northwestern Energy is also interested in this. I think someone's on the line. I think Ms. Dannon's on the line for that. Maybe she should be heard too, because I think we have consulted, and we are both companies do have essentially the same concerns with this. So I'll be happy to proceed however the commission wishes.
Well, let me propose this, and anyone can object. My thought would be, first, let's take up the issue whether or not staff's a party. We'd allow you to go. You've made an argument, Mr. Gerdes, your client's made an argument that staff shouldn't be allowed to make such a filing. If the commission decides you're right, then we're done. So my thought would be, we'll hear from you, then we'll hear from staff, then we'll hear from any other party on that. Does that make sense?
That's fine with me.
Let's start that. Mr. Gertis, take it away on the question as to whether or not staff is a party.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, there's a principle of law that says that a legal action cannot be brought by anyone other than the real party in interest. And the point that I made simply there is that from my reading of the statute, it does not appear that staff is a real party in interest, and as a matter of fact, that it is the companies that are regulated are real parties in interest. Here, we were given a petition which did not really, in our opinion at least, fully expose all of the issue, all of the sides of the issue, nor did it contain all the facts that I would suggest are ready for or that are necessary for the commission to make a decision. And so from my reading of the statute, it simply seems to me that the pipeline operator is certainly a real party in interest, and I don't see anywhere where staff is a real party in interest, especially given the other argument that we made, and that is that the commission does not have jurisdiction over this proceeding, because the way the statute is written, it restricts the applicability of the statute only to pipelines that are operated at a hoop stress of more than 20% of specified minimum yield strength. Those facilities that are operated at a hoop stress of less than 20% of specified minimum yield strength are excluded from the statute, which, and by the very entry in the first filing by staff states in that petition that, in fact, this is a pipeline that is operated at less than 20% of specified minimum yield strength. Thus, the commission has nothing to decide. That's the other part of our argument. Because this operation is outside the jurisdiction conferred by the statute. And so that would be the other half of my argument.
Staff, comments?
Well, I believe Mr. Gertis hit on two points that really aren't relevant to the question whether or not staff is a party. The first one was whether or not staff fully exposed all issues and facts. That doesn't have any bearing on whether or not staff's an interest. And the second one was the crux of the question, the 20% of SMICE issue, again, that has nothing to do with whether staff's a party in interest. This is the very question that staff should be asking. This is the very type of question staff should be asking. Interpreting the statutes and the rules that staff is assigned with enforcing and applying, I believe we are a party in interest, and it makes no sense to me that a declaratory ruling is only an option available for operators.
Thank you. Ms. Dannon, any comments for your client on this question? I'm sorry, Ms. Dannon, you said something. I didn't hear it.
I don't have any comments as regards to this issue. I would reserve our comments for how to proceed going forward with this docket.
Perfect. Thanks very much, Ms. Dannon. Any other comments from anybody else? I think those are the only parties. Great. With that, any commissioner questions on this question?
I just have one, Mr. Chairman. What caused this? Was there, Mr. Sullivan, were you in the field and you were denied access to inspect, or what actually prompted this to come before us?
Three things, actually. During normal inspections, we calculate SMICE and look at MAOP on pipelines to see where it's at, and we do that on routine inspections, and that came up when we were at MDU. I hadn't looked at this particular segment of pipeline before, and that came up, and that was of importance to me because before that, about a month before, we'd hit a similar situation with another pipeline where we talked about it, and they lowered the MAOP to be within 20% of SMICE. And then there's other parts of the regulations with welding issues that are affected by the definition of operate. So we felt we needed to have it that defined. Does operate mean at a point in time, or does it mean all the way up to the MAOP? So the crux of this is, what is the definition of operate? And from that, we want to know from the commission how they feel about that, because we feel it should be the same definition as used in pipeline safety.
Now, specified minimum yield strength, that's what the pipe was constructed to do, correct?
Commissioner, I'm sorry to interrupt you, and certainly it's your prerogative. I'd like to keep us, if possible, focused just on the question as to whether or not staff is a party. Mm-hmm. And so if you're willing to, I'd ask you to hold your line of questioning until we get into the merits of the issue.
Oh, sure. Gotcha.
Sorry. Thanks very much. Any other questions?
I might have one here for maybe Mr. Gerdes and maybe staff, too. I mean, when I look at the actual language of the rule, it doesn't use the word party. That word doesn't appear. What it uses is the word person. And, you know, at least at that level, and I didn't bring my 126 up here, but my recollection is that in 126 at least, the term person clearly includes governmental agency. So I think we get down to, when we look at the language of the rule, to me, if we don't dispute the fact that staff has the status of a person, I think the issue really then is in the declaratory rule is the language that says, as to the applicability to that person of any statutory provision. And I guess the argument, if I might characterize it, Mr. Gerdes, is you're asking the commission to take an extremely narrow view of that particular phrase, in the sense of meaning to be on the butt end of the statute, I guess. But couldn't that not reasonably be construed to include, it is staff's responsibility to carry out both the pipeline safety program and the Siting Act to do the commission's advocacy work relative to that, and the applicability of that statute to them in that role. I mean, one certainly could argue that language would be broad enough, could you not, to envision it encompassing that?
I don't see staff being affected by anything that's done on the pipeline. Staff may have an interest on behalf of the commission, but I don't see staff as being affected. And again, I'll say that that coupled with the fact that this entire proceeding is outside the realm of the statute, because the very thing that we're talking about is excluded from the statute. And so I would submit that however you base it, that staff doesn't have standing.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I could. Mr. Gerdes, you state that you could see that the staff might have an interest as far as the commission is concerned, but in the trifurcation of the commission, this staff is representing the citizenry. And so does not that make a difference in the fact that the staff, if the staff has, in your words, may have a standing as far as the commission's interest, don't they have an interest as far as the citizenry interest? And if we excluded them in this, in a precedent, does that not exclude their interests in other dockets as well, and doesn't that put the citizenry at risk of being represented here?
Well, along that line, Commissioner, it seems to me that if a citizen who was potentially affected by this pipeline sought to obtain redress, I'd have to agree with you. But this isn't based on any citizen complaint. This is solely brought by staff. And I realize it's a technicality, but I think it's a valid technicality.
But we don't place that burden on every instance that if a citizen does not object or does not file for. I mean, isn't that the entire purpose of the staff having that relationship where we have those different segments of the staff? That's the entire purpose of the staff.
I wouldn't quarrel with you there, Commissioner. But I think if you read literally what the commission's rule says, and compare it to the statute, I think that as a technical matter, staff doesn't have standing. That's why I'm making the point.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I would move that the commission find staff has the ability to, and in fact, in this case, does have party status. I'd make a few comments on my pending motion. I think when you read the federal and state chapters surrounding this pipeline safety, it's clear that obligations are given not only to the inspected, but also to the inspectors. I think very clearly, you know, those people doing the inspections they're very clearly affected by all of these rules. And I think there's a very real benefit for all of us in making sure that there's widespread clarity. And I think allowing only the inspected to ask for clarifications creates a not altogether healthy asymmetry in who's asking the questions and in what way. Second, I do think it's healthy to have inspectors who are not overly presumptive about their authority and are not overly confident in their authority and, in fact, are willing to pause from time to time and ask clarifications about exactly what the commission thinks the statutes or rules say. I do think that there is I think individual citizens certainly could intervene or raise an issue if they had an individual interest, but I think even broader than that is the public interest. I think very clearly there's a public interest. I think there is public interest in this and in all things that government does, or else it wouldn't be government's business. That's sort of the definition of government action, and I do think acting in the public interest, staff very much has a right to party status. Any other comments on the pending motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to add that I appreciate the semantics and the challenges and that the good barrister, Mr. Gerdes, has presented to us, and I think that we should probably take a serious look then at if there is some ambiguity at the rule and make sure that there's clarification. I agree with your comments and appreciate them.
Thanks. Other comments? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen? Now, the question for the commission is whether or not staff will have party status in this situation. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. I mean, at this point, I wonder if we don't have, and we'll double-check with Ms. Dannon, but at least with Mr. Gerdes and Ms. Semmel, I wonder if we don't have an alignment of a desire for next steps. Staff did suggest a 60-day, waiting for 60 days before taking any action. If it's all right with you, Mr. Gerdes, I would just maybe throw that out as an option and allow everybody an opportunity to comment. I mean, do you have an alternative action in mind?
No, I don't. I think it would be, as a matter of fact, I think it would be helpful for us to have an ability to develop this. And again, as I said, I'm happy that staff did take that position because I understood last week that staff wanted you to make a decision today. And so I thought I was kind of up against the wall when I filed the pleading I did. But I'm happy to see that we can have some time to work through this.
Well, and I understand your presumption. I mean, the agenda says how shall the commission rule on the petition for declaratory ruling. So I don't think your presumption was probably in error. Staff, any comments on...
Well, I think the error is in assuming staff wouldn't have worked with you had you asked Mr. Gerdes. The only reason staff is suggesting we give an extension is not because we were wrong. It's not because we read the rule incorrectly. 60 days is 60 days, whether Mr. Gerdes or Mr. Dannon filed comments or not. So I'm suggesting this only because we do want the help, and we do want the comments. And, in fact, staff, and the moment of filing this, we sent the petition to all operators, and we discussed this at the pipeline workshop. We requested comments. So I oppose the frame that Mr. Gerdes has put this in as a staff error and that staff didn't want comments. We do. And had I been called, had I been asked this, I would have made the suggestion a week ago.
Well, I'll let Ms. Dannon respond to this.
Ms. Dannon, comments?
First of all, I echo the sentiments of Mr. Gerdes. We, too, were surprised when we got the agenda asking for the commission to rule on the declaratory judgment. I'm not presuming that anybody misread any rules out there, but we, too, were directed to the administrative rule that says the commission should file an or should rule on this matter within 60 days, barring the commission does not request any more information from the parties. I think the lines of communication probably could have been opened on both ends, but I would go back to the rules of the statute.
Ms. Dana, we just started losing you. Again, I think it's a problem on our end, but maybe speak a little slowly. I think our system will pick up better then.
Okay. I think the lines of communication probably could have been opened on both ends. However, I would like to go back to the rules and the statutes. And declaratory rulings by nature are contested cases pursuant to SDCO 12615. And any contested case needs to have notice and an opportunity to be heard. And putting it on the agenda for a commission meeting 7 days before the actual meeting does not give us an opportunity to present witness and evidence and testimony. So I guess we would go back to that and allow for a longer time frame to happen so we can all present, give the commission the information it needs to make the correct decision here.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Dannon.
If I may add, I think we need to just calm down here. I have an email in front of me which basically says that the word shall in the rule doesn't offer much flexibility, and I understood that to mean that this thing was going to go, it was on a track to go to final hearing today. And so
that email was with Ms.
I regret
that. Ms. Semler, let's give Mr. Gerdes an opportunity to finish.
And I'm sorry that it staff's offended, but at that point I didn't feel I had anything else to do, and I apologize if someone's upset over all this. But I had to look out for my client, too, and I was basing it on not on thin air, but on the words that I saw on paper.
This is Ms. Dannon, and I would like to add...
Ms. Dannon, let's go ahead and give Ms. Summer an opportunity to respond, and then we'll go right back to you.
That email was with Ms. Dannon, and I don't know why anyone was surprised. The rule says what it says. It says 60 days for a decision to be made, and we are ahead of the 60 days. This was simply the last meeting that was prior to the expiration. So, the interveners are represented by counsel, and if they saw it was fit to file comments, I assumed they would have within that time frame.
Ms. Dannon?
I would again go back to the rule that the commission's responsibility to ask for more information. I'm not blaming staff, I'm not blaming us, but we received no kind of guidance from the commission on whether they needed anything else from either party before making their decision. And I would also remind the commission that we were just granted party status 18 days ago. And again, go back to the rule that this needs time to be noticed and heard before proceeding with any decision today.
Okay, we'll see if there are any commissioner questions. Again, the topic under discussion is whether or not to extend commission action on this for 60 days. Hearing no questions, any comments?
Yeah, I guess that's why I started down the other line of questioning, was I was thinking we were going to make a declaratory ruling today, but having heard everything, I think there's only one thing that I agree with, and that would be Mr. Gerdes's
opinion that maybe we just need to step back from this for a little bit and regroup. So I would think that the 60 days would be appropriate.
May I make a comment?
I would just like to, yes, I agree with what Commissioner Kolbeck said, but I believe that was part of staff's memo yesterday or prior to that, in which there would be a 60-day. So, I agree with that.
Just can I make one comment? I have a feeling Ms. Semler might have been just about ready to say something about this, too. And that just is the 60 days. I mean, if we're looking at this as going down the contested case pathway, you know, might we be better off just treating it that way and not set an arbitrary deadline of days and have it just proceed like any other case around here. As long, you know, staff, as the petitioning party, you're the party that has to agree to a delay beyond the 60-day, you know, beyond the original 60-day period. And I'm sort of like, why don't we just treat this like any other case at this point?
As a complaint?
No. Okay. Nope. Just as any other case, as any kind of case, any case we have before us, any filing. We have petitions of all different types. The only thing that 60 days does is gives the petitioner a presumptive right or a right that he can reject to have it determined within that 60 days. But there, other than that, there's no limitation. We take years sometimes to decide petitions.
Well, I hope it doesn't take years, but we're open to the extension and suggested it. So let's...
Okay. I mean, I'm just bringing that up and treat it like a normal proceeding where people can, we can go through a round of things. I mean, as I understand it right now, there's no issue here about an operator actually operating, right, a pipeline in excess of the... So we're not talking about an actual... I mean, it hits me that there's no extreme sense of urgency other than for staff to need at some point here to be able to get a resolution as to how we deal with this. Is that correct? Okay, thanks.
I don't know that, this is Commissioner Johnson, I don't know that I disagree with you, Mr. Smith, but I also don't think that this is likely to end up in the final analysis being very complicated. I think some decisions need to be made about what the words mean, but I think the parties probably have a pretty fair idea of where they're going to come down on this. Part of me just says, well, let's do 60 days, and if that's going to be insufficient, then we can always come back. But we've got the petitioner has filed a request for an extension for 60 days. I'm inclined to grant that rather than some open-ended extension.
Commissioner Johnson?
Yes, Ms. Dana.
Can I suggest that we handle this, like as Mr. Smith said, like any other regular proceeding? And in most other regular proceedings in front of you, we usually agree to some sort of procedural schedule. And if we can agree to like a schedule where we can submit comments and have rebuttal, and if we can get it done within 60 days, we'll work our tail off to get it done. But can the parties at least have a chance just to sit down and agree to some timelines and go that way?
Is your suggestion in lieu of a 60-day extension or in addition to that operating within that 60-day extension, a procedural schedule would be filed?
Either.
Okay, well, yeah, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, when it comes time to make a motion, I mean, if it's me making the motion, I'll certainly include that. Unless anybody has any, have any comments in opposition that I should hear before making that determination. Okay, other comments or questions by commissioners?
And Mr. Curtis, could I ask you a question? Your client is in every way open to dealing with this problem. They just want to resolve this problem. I just want to make sure that this doesn't end up, as Kara maybe stated, that goes on for years. We don't want an extension. Is this something that we can deal with before the end of the summer? Are you confident?
I'm sure we can.
Okay.
Okay.
Any commission action? I would move that the commission extend the decision timeline for 60 days and request that the parties develop a procedural schedule using that 60 days as a basis. Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. I believe that's let me ask, is there any other business to come before the commission? I believe this is the only business that's been noticed. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Motion has been made. We'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0.